Kia ora, tena tatau katoa, no mai, haere mai. Hi again, and welcome to Emran's Podcast, episode 102. Today is Tuesday, July 22nd, 2008. This is Māori Language Week in New Zealand, and so I began today with a bit of Māori. Kia ora just means hello. Tena tatau katoa is a formal greeting which includes everyone, including yourself. And no mai, haere mai are just two different ways of saying welcome. So, welcome. The opening national anthem today is that of Belgium, because on this day in 1831, Leopold I was crowned as the first king of Belgium. And it followed the Belgian Revolution of 1830, which ultimately led to, of course, Belgian independence. And although it wasn't formally recognized until 1839, but nevertheless, today is essentially Belgium's national day, and so we had the Belgian national anthem. Now, today I'm going to tell you a bit about becoming Kiwi, not the process of immigration, but the process of assimilation, essentially. Some of the things that I did and that I went through. And then after that, I have a few updates about things I did over the weekend and things that are coming up, which affect the podcast. And then the usual comments and that sort of thing. But first, I've got a couple of items in the news I wanted to share. And first is, I mentioned a while ago about the Catholics from India who were going to the World Youth Day festivities in Australia and how they'd gone missing, you know, while they were in Auckland. Now, technically, they're still legally in Auckland because they would have had probably a six-month tourist visa, and or certainly 3 months anyway. So they, at this stage, are not in the country illegally. I should hasten to add that. However, they're mostly unaccounted for. Well, it turns out originally they were supposed to be about 12 or 18 or something, but it turns out there's more like 30, 35, something like that, or fewer than 40 anyway, but it's getting up there. The authorities have since spoken to about half of them, and it turns out that they paid immigration people, or I should say they paid con artists in India, up to $17,000 to get a work permit in New Zealand, and that's what they thought they were getting. And it came as a surprise to them when they came to New Zealand and only received a visitor permit, and a visitor's visa, tourist visa, essentially. And so that's partly why they went missing, because, I mean, a number of these people apparently borrowed the money for this, and they have no real way of paying it back. And so they're sort of beside themselves. Well, one way or another, something will be sorted out, but the immigration department is adamant that these people must leave when their visas expire or they will be forcibly removed. And of course, if that happens, then they won't be allowed back for years. But so clearly there was a bit more to the story than it was originally reported. And actually, just a quick word about Pope Fest. It is over now, of course. The Pope's gone back to Italy. But one of the things that I thought was interesting about that was that the media, well, primarily the organizers of the event, were constantly predicting huge numbers of people would turn out. And in fact, the numbers were actually quite a bit lower. I mentioned that there were supposed to be something like 150,000 people at an event at Darling Harbour, and it turned out there were about 110,000. And for the big mass with the Pope, they were predicting 500,000 people would turn up, and depending on who you listen to, is maybe 350,000 tops. Now, I know people who have been to Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras in Sydney, which attracted far more people than that. And of course, it's not unusual for organizers to overestimate the number of people who are going to turn out at their event because they want to build hype and attention and excitement and all that sort of thing. But I did think it was kind of interesting that the numbers were, in some cases, dramatically lower than they were originally promising. But as I say, all event organizers exaggerate how many people are going to show up. It seems to be, I don't know, part of the requirement of the job. Also in the news, the New Zealand Census is looking at asking people if they are heterosexual, homosexual, or bisexual. Now, this isn't going to be coming up for a few years. The New Zealand Census is conducted every 5 years, and the next one is in 2011, and they're not planning on asking it then, but the one after that. So we're talking 2016 before they actually ask it. Now, this is similar in some ways, it's sort of the opposite, I guess, to what's going on in the U.S., where the U.S. Census will count legally married same-sex couples as being unmarried partners because they, under the Defense of Marriage Act, they cannot count legally married same-sex couples. Well, in New Zealand, they've been asking people about their relationship status since at least 1996. And in the 96 census, which, by the way, is the first one I took part in, there were 3,255 couples that identified as having a same-sex partner. And in the 2006 census, the most recent, that had doubled to 6,171. Now, of course, it's not that there has been a doubling of the number of people in couples, same-sex couples, in that decade. It's more that people have come to trust the integrity of the system. And the thing of it is that in New Zealand, the actual census forms aren't retained. They are destroyed fairly quickly. Whereas in the U.S., they're microfilmed, or whatever it is they do with them these days, and they keep them virtually indefinitely, or they try to. And census forms exist all the way back to the very first census that was conducted in the U.S., although they're incomplete for many of the early years. Nevertheless, the U.S. doesn't get rid of them. New Zealand does. So what we're really talking about pretty much is an aggregate, is aggregate data that will eventually be held. Nevertheless, there are some people who you might think would have some concerns about that. But the fact that more and more same-sex couples are willing to self-identify on the census form tends to indicate that people are more relaxed about the government holding that sort of information. Now, of course, in the 2006 census, there was a Labour government, and that may or may not have influenced people's willingness to be honest. I don't know. If the next census, if when the next census is conducted, there's a Conservative government, maybe they won't be so forthcoming. It's really hard to say. But be that as it may, the reason behind it is that there is no reliable data on the sexual orientation of the people in the country. And New Zealand would be the first country in the world to take this on if it actually ends up happening. Historically, of course, authorities have shied away from asking this sort of thing. But the reason that they're asking, that they're looking at asking this question, because it isn't official yet, and I'll read this directly from an article in the New Zealand Herald. It says, the discussion paper says health authorities need data on gay, lesbian, and bisexual populations because they have higher rates of suicide, physical and verbal assault, bullying, depression, smoking, alcohol and drug dependence, and workplace discrimination. Now, that may or may not be true. I mean, some of that's possibly debatable. But how that's going to be determined simply by somebody indicating their sexual orientation, I don't know. But the next paragraph says, other agencies are considering changes in welfare benefit entitlements for same-sex couples living together, adoption and family law, and hospital and school policies. Now, some of that they would already be able to work out from the existing data that they collect, where people identify themselves as same-sex partners, as Nigel and I, in fact, have done. However, the problem is that not all gay couples live together. There are plenty of couples where the partners have separate households for whatever reason. And those people currently are not counted in the census. They're counted as single. If they're in the house by themselves, or if they have flatmates, they're in a house with unrelated household members or whatever. So these people aren't counted, and so the government has no real way of knowing how many gay, lesbian, bisexual people there are in order to provide services that might be relevant to those peoples. Now, I do notice that it doesn't ask specifically about transgendered people, but I think that is actually covered under the gender section of the census. It's been quite a while now. It's been over 2 years, so I don't really remember anymore, to be honest, but I think it very well could be. At any rate, it's an interesting thing that they're looking at doing, and I mean, it goes way beyond simply recording people's relationship status, and it'll be interesting to see if it ends up surviving. But the main thing I wanted to talk about today was about this whole idea of becoming Kiwi. And as I said, it has nothing to do with immigration, but rather about the process of assimilation. Now, I am well aware that there are plenty of people who think that there are immigrant groups who don't want to fit in, who remain separate and distinct and keep their own institutions. In New Zealand, they tend to think that those are Asians. In America, they might be Hispanic. But the point is that in almost every country, the majority dislikes a certain minority because they say that they don't try to fit in. Now, I had it easy. Coming from an English-speaking country and having European ancestry, I fit in just by look, and I could understand what they were saying easily, even if I didn't always understand the slang, at least not at first. But I did still try to do certain things to try to fit in more. And I've talked about some of this before, about how I read New Zealand history to try to understand where the people came from, figuratively speaking, as well, literally as well, and to understand some of what path the country took in its development. I also went out of my way to read novels and magazines, watch movies and television shows from New Zealand, so that I could kind of get a cultural sense of the country. And, of course, I tried to learn something about Maori culture because as the tanga te whenua, or people of the land, obviously it behooves any immigrant to try to understand something about that. Now, of course, since Nigel is Maori, it was somewhat easier for me because his family could teach me things. And that was obviously handy for me, but not all immigrants get that. But the thing is that through all of this, I sort of began to get sort of a feeling about what New Zealand was all about and what New Zealanders were all about. And it made it easier for me to just have everyday conversations with people. However, there came a point where I guess I was so assimilated that people, this was at my old workplace, would talk about those bloody immigrants and going on about them. And I'm like, hello, immigrant over here. And it was like they didn't even seem to notice I was immigrant anymore. And I was a bit uncomfortable with that, to be honest, because sometimes the people they were railing against were Asians. Sometimes it would be Māori, actually, or Polynesians. And I never quite knew how to respond because, especially in the early days when I wasn't yet even a permanent resident, I felt I don't really have any grounds to criticize New Zealand because I'm not one of them in any real sense of the word. I'm just sort of here by their good graces kind of thing. After I became a permanent resident, I felt a little bit more secure in expressing my opinions about things. And then certainly once I became a citizen, the gloves are off. And if somebody says something stupid, I'll challenge them on it. And that includes when I think they're being irrational in their political views against labor in particular, but in favor of national, very often people can say the most outrageously irrational things, much as people in America will say irrational things in support of the Republican Party. It's the same kind of thing. And now I stand up to them if people say things like that. Not all of the time. I mean, just like nobody anywhere is 100% ready to fight back all the time. You have to pick your battles. You know, if you're vastly outnumbered, you don't necessarily want to start a fight. But Kiwis are not confrontational people by nature. They don't get into arguments with people, and they won't even loudly express their opinions unless they already know you. By and large, there are exceptions, of course. However, the gist of it is that people don't go out of their way to pick a fight. And so for a newcomer trying to assimilate, it's not like you have to walk through this minefield all the time. That's not the case. But a newcomer, particularly if they're of European ancestry, may notice things that somebody who is of a different ethnicity might not notice because Kiwis will be on their better behavior around a person like that. So it's kind of interesting, I guess, that this process that one goes through in learning to fit in to the new culture. Now, I've always been of the belief that somebody who immigrates to a country has a moral obligation to try to adopt that culture to the extent possible and practical. Now, there's certain things that may be non-negotiable. I'm not going to go down that road of what is and what isn't, because a lot of that is a personal thing. Individuals have their own bottom lines, is what I'm trying to say. However, in general, people should adopt the dominant culture that they're going into, but it doesn't mean that they have to forsake and abandon and just get rid of their previous culture. And in a way, I'm a good example of that, because when I first came to New Zealand, I felt very, especially in these days when I was having coworkers saying things about immigrants, I felt very unsure of myself and my place. And as I became a permanent resident and later a citizen, I became sure of my place in New Zealand. And I never doubted my connections to America. That was all still strong. But now I'm quite free to express those American sides. So, for example, every November I have a small Thanksgiving dinner. It's not as elaborate as we'd have in America because it's usually bloody hot that time of year. I don't really want to do a full roast dinner. At any rate, I do that. We sometimes have a barbecue at 4th of July. We didn't this year because there were people out of town and things, so it just wasn't convenient. But we often do, even though it's the middle of winter, and those kinds of things. And every once in a while we do an American sort of thing. I can't give you a specific example. Oh, I suppose like pizza and beer. Although I haven't done that in years because I've been trying to avoid beer and kind of the gout. But my point basically is that I don't forsake my American heritage, such as it is, or my American culture, I suppose I should say. And people do ask me about American history. They ask me about current events in America. And this may come as a big surprise, but I actually try to answer those questions in a non not necessarily nonpartisan, but in a as matter of fact a way as possible, by sticking to the simple facts, like how a president is chosen, forgetting about stealing elections and election fraud and those kinds of things. Instead, I just try to concentrate on the mechanics of it and explain what is happening at any given point. And then they usually ask me what I think about it, and that's different than I'll tell them. But I don't try to tell people that my way is the only way, because it certainly isn't. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that through the process of becoming Kiwi, I also became in some ways stronger in my own cultural identity. And now on the census form, when they ask me what my ethnicity is, I say American. Because after all these centuries of my family in, well, decades, I suppose, of my family in the U.S., I don't feel any need to identify with my European ancestry anymore. I identify with my American ancestry. So I suppose, in a sense, by becoming Kiwi, I became a better Yankee, too. Well, anyway, that's all I really wanted to say about that. And now I am going to jump over to the comments. And, I'm going to do the written comments first. And a couple more on episode 100. First up was Freddie, who said, "I love hearing you read emails. You often make us sound much more butch when reading our writings out loud than I'm sure we sound in person. Happy 100th. And I said, "I've no idea how butch sound in real life, but I always thought I made them sound like big old girls' blouses. Who knew? Thanks for the wishes." And next up was Ramble Redhead, who said, "Happy 100. This show is very interesting, and I certainly understand not doing a big production or for milestone shows. As far as asking for reviews, do what you want. That is what is important, because it's your show. Reviews do help you get more listeners." His reviews, I think he means listeners. But word of mouth works as well. And I said, "Thanks for the wishes. I figure that if I wait until later on, I might be able to pull off a special episode without it being too naff. The existing examples are pretty intimidating, by which I mean in particular Auntie Vera Charles." And I said, "The truth is, I bore myself talking about iTunes reviews, which is why I don't often mention them. Besides, I'm pretty far along in my goal anyway." And I am, actually. I checked just before I started recording, and I had 19 iTunes reviews in iTunes USA, the only country so far that I have iTunes reviews. And interestingly, one of the reviews by Big Dumb Donkey Girl has had 5 listeners say that it's helpful, 5 out of 5, which makes it the most helpful of all the reviews in iTunes, which I thought was really interesting because it's one of the most recent. And I've often said that those of you who want to help any podcast, not just mine, you don't necessarily have to leave a review. If you just go to the iTunes page for that podcast, and when it asks, "Was this review helpful?" just click yes to the 5-star reviews, and that helps the podcaster as well. So, yep, that's all I want to say about iTunes reviews, mercifully. And I do bore myself talking about it, so that's why I don't. And now on to episode 100. Sorry, 101. And first up was Archer, who said, "I like how you called this one a snack-sized episode." And I said, "Then you like the Tuesday format, because they'll remain snack-sized portions for the time being, except for today's, which, since I didn't do Friday, has to be a bit longer. But I'll explain that in a minute or two." And next up, I don't know how to pronounce your name, I'm sorry, Erez or something. Maybe you can let me know. Anyway, says, "Hello. I found this podcast, iTunes New Zealand, a few weeks ago, and only now I managed to listen to a full show. I think it's great. As an immigrant to New Zealand myself, it's very interesting to hear other experiences of immigration. I never had to do the personal investigation, but a friend of mine did, and it was pretty much the same story. About the education bit, the New Zealand system is called NCEA. Thanks for the podcast." And I said, "Welcome. I like to share immigrant experiences, both my own and others, so you're welcome to share yours. Thanks for the NCEA tip." And what that's referring to is I talked about how a Kiwi living in the U.S. was saying that she didn't graduate from high school. And I couldn't remember what the qualifications was called now. It's now called NCEA, which is National Certificate in Educational Achievement, I think is what it stands for, if I remember correctly. I may get that screwed up too. But it is the current system that's used. And it's really difficult for me to explain, and I'd really like to get Nigel's sister on to talk about how education works in New Zealand. And I'm working on her, so I might yet get her on. But also, I went to check out Ediz's photos on Flickr, and they are fantastic. Go to episode 101. Go to the comments and click on his name, and it will take you to his Flickr site. And he has some really amazing photos there. Anyway, next up was Tim Carmel, who said, "Very interesting show. Even though the immigration process seemed an ordeal, it sounds like it's not near as bad as immigrating to the U.S. I know people who've been trying to get their citizenship for years with all kinds of lawyer expenses involved. A friend of mine just got his U.S. citizenship a couple of weeks ago. Great show. I love hearing your stories." And I said, "I do think that immigrating to New Zealand is easier than to the U.S., and my impression is that gaining New Zealand citizenship is easier, or at least no harder than in the U.S. I'll be sharing more of my own stories in the weeks ahead." And actually, I've thought about it since I wrote that. I think that the system in New Zealand is easier for gaining citizenship in the sense that you don't have to take any kind of test or anything. Most of the stuff you have to go through is to gain permanent residence. And once you've gotten to that part, it's just a matter of waiting out the time and paying the fee, essentially, in order to take the next step to become a citizen, because you're supposed to prove English proficiency in order to gain residence. And you've already proven you have good character, in other words, no police record, in order to get residence. And providing that you've behaved yourself within New Zealand, you don't have to do that again. So you're pretty much, you know, on the way. So I do think it's probably somewhat easier in New Zealand after all. And next up was Ramble Redhead, who said, "Very interesting show. It is amazing that we as members of the GLBT community have to go through, and glad things have improved with the process. And I said, "Yeah, I agree. We often have to put up with a lot. But things do change. They just change faster in some places than in others." And I think New Zealand is one of those places where things change pretty quickly. Because New Zealand went from a society that was very anti-gay. They had sodomy laws against gay male sex, not lesbian sex, but gay male sex. They had no protections against discrimination for gay men or lesbians or transgendered. So you could be fired, you could be evicted, any number. You could be refused credit or accommodation, all of those sorts of things. So it went from that kind of society to one that not only had full civil rights protections, but also civil unions, which are marriage in all but name, in the space of 19 years. And they went from the repressive society to one where civil rights were guaranteed in, I think it was 8. And it took about basically another decade to get civil unions. But there's still work to be done. Adoption law is unequal at the moment. As the law stands right now, a gay couple can foster a child, and it is possible to go to a court and get an order essentially making that foster arrangement permanent, but they cannot adopt a child. A gay single person can adopt a child, but a gay couple cannot, which is just dumb. It's just stupid. And I have no idea why that is. Maybe there was some rationale back at the time, or maybe they just forgot to change one law and they changed another one. I don't know. But there is talk about changing that. It's one of the things that article was alluding to when they talked about family law. They do want to remove that restriction that prevents gay couples from adopting and normalizing it, since obviously a single gay person can adopt. I'm sure they're thinking that a gay couple would make a better home. And the fact that they do allow gay couples to have a permanent foster relationship suggests that there's no, what's the word I'm looking for, philosophical reluctance to it, I guess. But next up, I have a phone comment.
Hello, Mr. Arthur. I just got done listening to Archer. I'm calling to wish you a happy 100th show, even though I'm like 2 shows late. But also, I sent you an email about Gallup, but I sent it to your Gmail account. So, congratulations, and I look forward to many, many more shows from you. Bye.
Well, thanks for that, Tim. And don't worry about the Archer Arthur thing. People do that all the time. I've been actually on Archer's group show, and people get the names mixed up. Actually, there have been times I've heard when I'm not on the show, people get the name mixed up. But anyway, well, through the magic of internet technology, I actually have that email he's referring to right in front of me. And he says, "Take your cherries. I don't know if you have GNCs down there, but they have black cherry concentrate in pill form daily. I'm not sure if you can order them down there. Also, Walmart has great black cherry cranberry juice also. But check out any organic food or vegetarian shops. I've surprisingly found cherry juice in major grocery stores here in the States. As much as I've started and stopped gout meds, and the attacks aren't any worse. Actually, some of my worst ones were when I was on the meds. So I'm damned if I do and damned if I don't. My key things that aggravate my gout are black beans, anything high in iron, caffeine, alcohol, and the like. Just got to see what bothers it and stay away from it. Tim. Well, thanks, Tim. And you're absolutely right. You do have to just stay away from what aggravates it. In my case, the gout attacks are initiated almost exclusively by severe stress. If, say, I've got a major project due and I'm having trouble getting it done, that'll initiate a gout attack. As for the other stuff you mentioned, we don't have GNCs, although actually when I first came to New Zealand, there was one here in Auckland. It's now gone, I checked. And I haven't yet found anywhere that carries any black cherry concentrate, but I bet you're right that I can probably find it at a health food shop or maybe a vegetarian shop or organic food store or something like that. And I'm going to look around. It hadn't occurred to me to look for it in pill form, to be honest. But I am going to look more into the black cherry concentrate pills or something. And I'll let you all know how I get on with that. But thanks for the advice, Tim. I do appreciate that. And next, I also got an email from Freddie, who says, it's actually titled, Holy Shnikes. It says, $29 a gallon. Good thing you can ride your bike across the island. Happy 100. Cheers to many more. Did that sound butch? just kidding. But it's actually funny what he says about riding bike across the island. He is kidding, of course. But there are a lot of Americans who have no idea how big North Island and South Island really are. Because I had a friend with a graduate degree, a master's degree, who thought that we could just drive down to Wellington for the day. And Wellington, if you look at it on the map, it looks like it should take at least a day to get there, a full day to drive from Auckland to Wellington. But in reality, it takes about 12 hours because of the nature of the roads. And that's if the desert road is open. It is often closed. It's through the Central Plateau in the North Island around Mount Ruapehu and the ski fields there and so on. And it's not possible to do that, I assure you. You can't go down to Wellington for the day, for instance. It's three to 4 hours to the snow from here. In the central North Island around Lake Taupo and the mountain and so on. But I don't know. I mean, most Americans don't have a very good familiarity with world geography anyway, so I shouldn't be too surprised about that. But it is kind of funny because, believe me, New Zealand is bigger than you think it is. In terms of area, it's roughly the same size as Italy or the state of Colorado. It's just that it's spread out in two main islands that go a very long way. It's the world's southernmost city in Invercargill, and it also is the world's southernmost national capital, which is Wellington, of course. And it is bigger and harder to get around than you might think. Now, that's the comments. I made a decision on the fly to do all that before I talked about the more personal stuff. All I wanted to say was that over the weekend, we ended up going away. We had a family party down in Pauroa in the Waikato. And I just didn't have time to record on Friday. I ran out of time. Although I actually started an episode, I just didn't have time to finish it. And so I just thought, nah, I'll just give it a miss. And we'll try again this week. But this Friday is my mother-in-law's birthday. And she's coming up to stay with us for a few days. So I may very well not have time to record on Friday. But I have a solution. I'm actually going to record on Thursday and just not post it until Friday. So you'll still get your Amarin's podcast at the end of the week, as you'd expect. I may try to use the early posting features and see if that works. If not, it means you may get the podcast earlier than I intended. But we'll see. We'll see how it goes. I may just wait until first thing Friday morning, my time, and post it then. But nothing is going to change despite the fact that I'm going to be very busy this weekend. But that's it for today, everybody. Have a good rest of the week, and I will talk to you at the end of it. Hei konara. Bye. You can leave a comment on this or any other episode of the Amarin's Podcast at amarinspodcast.com. You can send an email to me at arthur@amarinspodcast.com, or you can ring my U.S. listener line on 206-339-8413. This podcast is produced and distributed under Creative Commons license. Complete details at the website.